African resources, uncovering labor violations by corrupt politicians and Western government powers. Learn what's happening now in interviews with artists, activists, scholars, and a host of other experts each episode. Listen Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Africa Now is also available on iTunes Podcast, Google Play Music, as well as SoundCloud on your station for Jazz and Justice, WPFW, Washington.
Elon Musk sunk millions of his dollars into Wisconsin's special election, but not enough voters were buying it. Social Security is considered a third rail of American politics, but is it untouchable under Trump and Musk? And how do white people decide what is racist or what is sexist? And why do we care? Author Betsy Leander Wright has the answers in her book, Is It Racist? Is It Sexist? Good morning, and welcome to What's at Stake. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Well, voters who went to the polls in Florida and Wisconsin's special election last night sent a message to America about President Trump and his co-president, Elon Musk. In the deep red state of Florida, the two GOP candidates, as expected, won. They won their elections, but by a significantly smaller margin than Trump won in 2024. It was approximately a 15 to 20 point lead against their Democratic opponents, but Trump won that state by 30 plus points less than 5 months ago. Nevertheless, Trump bragged and took credit for the victory, stating on his Truth Social platform, the Trump endorsement, as always, proved far greater than the Democrats' forces of evil. Congratulations to America, Trump said. Randy Fine, the winner, sought to downplay the narrowing margin, saying it was double digits and in a special election. His challenger, Democrat Josh Fine, shrank the margin by 15 points. He said the race was closer than anyone ever imagined and sends a warning sign to Trump, Fine, and the unelected oligarch taking apart the government. That unelected oligarch, Elon Musk, was not on the ballot in Wisconsin's special election last night, but the results were a clear referendum on his actions. Musk inserted himself into the race by visiting Wisconsin, parading across the stage at a rally wearing a cheesehead hat and handing out million-dollar checks to voters. Musk sunk millions of his dollars into the race for the state Supreme Court race, but the candidate he and Trump supported lost decisively. John Nichols is a national affairs correspondent for The Nation. He's written and co-written over a dozen books on topics ranging from histories of American socialism and the Democratic Party to analysis of U.S. global media systems. His latest book, co-written with Senator Bernie Sanders, is a New York Times bestseller list titled, It's Okay to Be Angry About Capitalism. And he joins us this morning from his home in Madison, Wisconsin, and he's pretty much our go-to guy for anything political coming out of Wisconsin. Good morning, John Nichols, and welcome to What's at Stake.
Good morning, Verna. I'm honored to be with you, and it is, I think, for Wisconsin progressives, a joyous day.
Yes, indeed. Well, we got your reaction there right off the top to those. Were they surprising results, do you think? Or did you have
Sure, they were surprising. That? Oh, I halfway expected it, but the truth of the matter is when the richest man in the world shows up and spends $25 million on an election that, you know, elections for Supreme Court in Wisconsin used to see, if they saw $1 million, that was considered a lot. When the richest man in the world shows up and spends $25 million, you have to have a little bit of a worry, you know, is money going to define our politics? It so often does. But in this election, we did get, I would suggest, not just a somewhat surprising result, a decisive result. Instead of being close, and I think I did sort of think that Susan Crawford, the progressive candidate, would probably pull it off, but she didn't just pull it off. She won by 200,000 votes with a 55-45 margin. That's a sweeping victory, and it's a sweeping victory for a candidate who ran saying that she was opposed to the Trump agenda, that she was opposed to Musk's money, and that she wanted to serve as a judge who represented the interests of people, of citizens and, you know, residents of Wisconsin, with the purpose of, you know, bringing justice as opposed to serving multinational corporations and, you know, wealthy oligarchs.
So I said that this election was really a referendum on Musk. Do you agree, or is that a little bit hyperbolic?
You're never hyperbolic, Verna. but I would say that there's a little more to it. In the last 120 hours, it became a referendum on Musk because he inserted himself into the race so thoroughly. He literally flew into Wisconsin, put a polyurethane cheese head on top of himself and jumped around a stage in Green Bay. So it was hard not to pay attention to that. And everybody was talking about it. But there were issues that underpinned this that I think are important. Brad Schimmel, the conservative candidate in the race, is a former Republican attorney general who was very, very close to the extreme right-wing former governor, Scott Walker. They assaulted voting rights, labor rights, civil rights. They really were bad players politically. And the understanding was that if Schimmel got back on the court, he would flip it to a 4-3 conservative majority. If Crawford, the more progressive candidate, won, it would remain a 4-3 progressive majority. So I think those issues, right, abortion rights, labor rights, voting rights, were present in people's minds as well. And that mix of concern about the issues, as well as, I think, a desire to send a message as regards the Trump agenda and as regards Musk's money, combined to create a very sweeping result for the progressive candidate.
So why, John, were Musk and Trump so invested in a win in this state's Supreme Court race? What's in it for them?
Well, John? One thing is Elon Musk
having a little bit of a technical challenge there.
I can hear you.
Okay, go right ahead. You had frozen for a moment.
Well,
so can you start that sentence over, if you will?
Of course, I'm delighted to do it. And look, the thing to understand is that in Wisconsin, there was a lot in play because the state is so closely divided. Wisconsin is the ultimate battleground state. In the last 7 presidential elections, 5 were decided by under 30,000 votes. As a result, elections often end up in court. And Donald Trump and Elon Musk wanted a conservative court that would be friendly to them. That's the first and foremost thing. The other thing is that that Elon Musk himself had filed a lawsuit in January in Wisconsin seeking to overturn our laws as regards car sales. In Wisconsin, we have a law that bars the sale of cars in the state by the manufacturer. It's an old law that kind of says that you shouldn't have one company controlling everything. Mm-hmm. And he is suing to overturn that law. That suit could well turn up in the Wisconsin Supreme Court.
So he wants to sell more. He wants to sell more of his cars. Is that it?
Yeah, he wants to control the sale of them. Right. Mm-hmm. So he manufactures cars, but he wanted to have the ability Tesla have the ability to sell them in Wisconsin off car lots. And our law says you can't do that. So he was trying to overturn that law. That lawsuit could well end up in the Supreme Court. So Susan Crawford, the progressive candidate, said, look, Elon Musk has a political interest in this race. He may well also have a business interest in this race. And as a result, the message was Wisconsinites have a very clear choice. They can either vote to effectively do the bidding of the wealthiest man in the world, or they can vote for a court that will judge cases based on the facts. And if the wealthiest man in the world is right, yeah, the court will give him his due. But if the wealthiest man in the world is wrong, you want a court that is able to say no to that wealth and no to that power. And that was the message that Susan Crawford, the progressive, delivered in this race.
So with the court now maintaining a liberal majority or progressive majority, I guess you all prefer.
Yep. That's how we say it.
How likely is it that going to affect Trump's national agenda, if at all?
Oh, no, I think that's a great question, Vernon. I think the answer is it's going to affect it potentially in some significant ways. Now, we know that Donald Trump has a big ego and that he doesn't like to be told no. And so I don't think he's going to stand up tomorrow or today even and say, I'm changing all my behaviors and all my activities. But he will recognize that there was a serious setback in Wisconsin, a battleground state that he narrowly won last November. And he will also recognize, I think, that Elon Musk is not necessarily a political asset. Musk has done a lot of controversial stuff. He has offended a lot of people, a lot of voters. And so I think the national impact is twofold. Number one, in combination with Cory Booker's filibuster yesterday, I think you had a moment where progressive forces, Democrats, look a lot stronger than they did 24 hours ago. They look like they're fighting back and even winning in some places. That strengthens the Democratic hand. I think it gives them a little more maybe courage and spine and backbone. At the same time, it also will make at least some Republicans wonder if going along with the whole Trump agenda, doing exactly what Elon Musk and Donald Trump say they should do, is the right move politically. So what Wisconsin does is sort of shake up the calculus and create a situation where I think politicians in Washington, you know, will, you know, kind of wake up this morning and, you know, if they're smart, they turn on this great station and listen to the news. But then they're going to sit back in their chair and as the jazz is playing through the day, maybe think a little bit about their choices and think a little bit about how they respond to the politics of the moment. So Wisconsin gave Washington something to think about.
And you have to wonder how Trump is going to respond to Musk's underperformance, let's just call it, in this particular race. you know, and whether or not some political analysts have said if he crashed and burned, which I think they'll agree that he did, it might slow him down a bit. And maybe Trump will sort of put him on the...
Yeah.
Tied a leash or something. At the same time, though, he's absorbing a lot of flack for Donald Trump because everybody's blaming him, and he's only doing what Trump wants him to do. But everybody's blaming Musk.
I think your point is well taken on many levels. It is probably advantageous to Donald Trump to have Elon Musk take most of the flack and to have Musk end up getting, even today, getting a lot of the blame for this result from Wisconsin, right? We're talking a lot about Musk, and maybe that's a little better for Trump. But I really want to emphasize, this isn't just about Musk. Musk is prominent politically. He is in the center of these discussions because of his association with Donald Trump. And so Trump has a tough choice to make. He can't just have Musk, you know, out there in front of him, taking all the hits and think that nobody's going to notice that Trump is standing there behind him. The fact of the matter is it's a Trump-Musk administration. And as long as Musk is in it, cutting federal jobs, shutting down federal agencies, cutting off aid to the most vulnerable people in the world and in the United States, threatening Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, as long as Musk is doing that, so publicly in interviews and in so many places, I think that's a real problem for the Trump administration. And it may feel like a much bigger problem today, because in addition to all the polling that shows that Musk is in that popular, now you have tangible election results that I think reinforce that message. As a result, I do think that there's a real chance that Donald Trump is going to, you know, maybe put a little more distance between himself and Musk. At the end of the day, though, as long as Musk is in there doing the stuff he's doing, I think Trump is still going to take a lot of the blame.
John Nichols is the national affairs correspondent for The Nation. John, thank you so much for joining us this morning on What's at Stake.
Verna, I am always honored to be with you. It is one of the great delights of getting to do radio now and again.
Fantastic. Sorry. You're breaking up a little bit.
Love to stick with you and listen to you. Great. Yeah.
Okay, great. Thank you, John.
Thank you so much.
Have a good day. Another shocking announcement from the Oval Office yesterday when Trump signed an executive order to fire 10,000 staffers at U.S. health agencies, according to multiple sources familiar with the situation. Security guards were standing by, barring entry to some employees just hours after they received dismissal notices. Democrats are searching for ways to stymie or halt the administration's drastic actions. House Democrats have set up a war room for constituents to come and describe the impacts these actions are having on them in real time. In a historic filibuster aimed at disrupting business as usual, Senator Cory Booker from New Jersey held the Senate floor for over 25 hours nonstop without bathroom breaks. He became somewhat emotional, however, while reading an email from one constituent who has Parkinson's disease, as his father does, and pleaded for the Senator Booker to protect her Social Security payments.
What kind of man is in our White House that makes fun of the disabled?
Parkinson's disease is a degenerative brain disease that progresses over time. Sorry, I'm thinking about my dad. It is unrelenting and affects motor and nerve processes. Loss of benefits will have a direct and daily effect on me and my family. I will need medication every single day of my life, and I will need the security of a generous society to care for me. Millions of others join me there. Please, Senator Booker, please protect my Social Security. I just thank God that my mom had the resources to take care of my dad, and I watched that degenerative disease take from his life for 20 years and how much it cost. I know so many Americans who live in fear every day that one little thing will happen to them that will destabilize their financial well-being. And now those millions of Americans, because of a president and a man named Musk, are driving fear into them. They have a president that talks down to them, that lies about the services that they rely on. What is this? It is not normal. How can the most powerful people in our land not comfort others, not tell them they have nothing to fear but fear itself, not tell them to have malice towards none but have charity towards all?
U.S. Senator Cory Booker from New Jersey during his historic filibuster on the floor of the Senate yesterday. Well, some 70 million retired Americans who have paid into the Social Security system throughout their entire work careers are anxious and confused about whether their benefits will be affected by Musk's cuts. Joining us to provide some clarity is Eric Kingson, Professor Emeritus at Syracuse University School of Social Work and Chairman of the Board of Social Security Works. Welcome to What's at Stake, Professor Kingson. Unmute yourself, please, Professor. There you go. Yep.
My students often thought it best when I was muted, but I make an exception here.
So Social Security has long been considered the third rail of politics. In other words, it's sort of somewhat a holy or sacrosanct, believed to be untouchable. But Musk has pretty much disregarded that. And my question is, have the closing of offices and requirements to have seniors go online to handle their business actually started to have an impact on the Social Security population as yet?
Absolutely. I think we all know when you go out and talk with folks, they're very worried about their Social Security benefits. It's remarkable the level of worry. Seniors are angry. People with disabilities are angry. Families aren't happy because they may have to spend more on their older or people with disabilities. Bottom line is they are violating the concept, the values that inform Social Security. Senator Booker said it very well. There's a notion of charity or that we're all in it together. This is not charity, but it's an earned right. People work for it and it's theirs for its insurance. When they retire or disabled or a working person dies. So normally I've never in many years of working on this program, never made the case that the system is in danger of going belly up. This time, because of what Trump and Musk are doing at Social Security, there's a realistic fear that benefits will not go out on time. Now, of course, some people don't worry about that, like the Secretary of Commerce, who said, talking about benefits not going out on time or being delayed a month, said, listen, by the way, he's a billionaire. My mother-in-law is 94, and if she didn't get her check for a month, it wouldn't be a problem. Yep.
Well, not everybody has a billionaire son-in-law.
Yeah.
But when you talk about checks going out, many Americans on Social Security get their benefits on a card. Is that going to be affected, or are they somehow protected?
Well, I'm saying that in general, the direct deposits, various ways of distributing, are at risk. What's happening is, in his hubris, the same hubris that brought him to Wisconsin, I suppose, Musk has asserted that he can fix Social Security. Now, there's nothing that he has asserted that it's a Ponzi scheme, that it's got people ages 150 and over receiving benefits forever. All of this is baloney. I could use different terminology. It's simply untrue. And first of all, I mean, there are all sorts of safeguards against continuing payments when someone died. The longest living American, I think, was 126 years old. But we have some, 100,000 people supposedly over 150. It's just an attempt to pull apart the system, undermine the confidence in the system. And they're doing a good job of that, which is very worrisome.
Mm. Well, the former head of the Social Security Administration predicted about a month ago that the system would likely crash and burn in 30 to 90 days and that seniors should begin saving their money. Is that still the case, in your opinion?
I think it's very possible. And part of what Musk is doing in his hubris is trying to change the computer system at Social Security. It's in need of significant updating and changing. However, it's been estimated it would take 5 to 10 years to do it. Musk says he's going to do it in 3 to 5 months with people who know nothing about Social Security. Technicians he brought in who believe they can make this kind of change seamlessly.
Hmm. So, you mentioned that change. What are some of the other changes still on the agenda, on Musk's agenda at this point? Because apparently pushback from constituents forced Musk to sort of retract some of his directives, did they not?
Well, there's some of that. But look, Social Security has been under attack since the day it was passed. Roosevelt faced it, Alf Landon, in the 1936 election, and his opponent was calling Social Security a fraud on the working man in the vernacular of the time. And there was a period for many years where there was pretty much bipartisan agreement, but there were still these attacks on Social Security from the far right. President Eisenhower said, yeah, there are a few folks who are willing to attack Social Security, but they are few and stupid. Now, we're in a different time. This attack we've had the attack based on it won't work. We got the attack based on it's unfair because millionaires don't get a high rate of return as working people. It's really, we ought to privatize it because we would do better by it. Next round of attacks. And the third round of attacks is the deficit, which, by the way, Social Security does not pay a penny, does not borrow a penny from the federal general revenues. It loans resources to the federal government and it gets interest paid back on that. So it's never affected the federal deficit at all.
So in other words, the money that is in the Social Security fund is money that workers actually contribute over the course of their work.
Yes, and it's current generations paying for current retirees, disabled people, but the system is as solid as it's fundamentally sound. Yes, there are shortfalls in the future we can address by asking millionaires and billionaires to pay the same contribution rate as everyone else, and also counting asset income.
Those wouldn't be the same billionaires that are trying to gut the system now.
So there have been these attacks. President Bush wanted to use his capital to partially or fully privatize Social Security. These guys are taking a different angle. They want to destroy it administratively, hollow it out, make the case that government is incompetent, Social Security is poorly administered, there's fraud, of which there's virtually none. It's remarkably well administered. And they want to use that money basically to help justify a huge tax cut that 90% goes to the very well off.
Well, Republicans have long wanted, Professor, to transition Social Security into a privatization system. How would that somehow be connected to the stock market, or would it be? And your thoughts about that?
Yeah. Thoughts are you would not want to be retiring today if this was a privatized system. Your dollars would have dropped dramatically. That's one reason why the public very much rejected privatization. There's something else going on, too. Social Security is a value. I think Cory Booker got to that very clearly. It's the notion that we're all in it together. We have obligations to work hard. And if you work hard, you should get something in return. We have obligations to care for our parents, our family. And we believe in human dignity, core value. And another piece of Social Security is the idea of security. Surprise. Not just financial security, but a sense of peace of mind, because we know that a portion of our retirement or disability is covered if we need it. So they have undermined not only the confidence in the system, but the sense of peace that millions, tens of millions of older people have, and people with disability. What they're threatening to do and what they've done already. Social Security was at its highest, was not 15 years ago, Social Security had 67,000 employees. Today it has about 57,000, even though 10,000 baby boomers have been retiring every day and reaching 65 every day. Mm-hmm. It has, it's scheduled to go down they want to cut another 7,000 employees out of it. The system is underfinanced because Congress doesn't have control of the benefit amounts, but it has control of whether or not it gives money to the Social Security Administration. It squeezed it. Waiting periods are 230 days for disability benefits. They're going to double to 400 and something days. The waiting time to get on the call-in line, as much as 2 hours sometimes. The notion that we can cut these people and deliver service is just doesn't pass the smell test. More than that, we already have these backlogs, and this will only further create problems. SSA at one point was giving directions to its work staff who work at home, and they said, you got to come into the office. We're not going to pay you if you're not in the office. That's, of course, if we didn't fire you first. Mm-hmm. Not going to pay you if you don't come into the office. And concurrently, they started closing offices.
Wow.
And they also started funneling more and more old people into direct meetings at SSA. There'll be a huge backup to get a meeting. Mm. So they're doing everything they can to make the system not work, and then to make the argument that it needs to be replaced. We need private, they may call it personal accounts, whatever it is, it's going to be privatization, and the risk will be on the American people. We're going to stop that. And the best thing is the American people don't want to see it cut. They're even, and this is Republican, Democrat, Independent, in polls, about 88% or so, 90% of them are saying, don't cut, raise, or eliminate the cap so that millionaires and billionaires pay the same, make some changes like an improved cost of living adjustment, this and that. And if necessary, you can also increase my payroll contribution. So, so that's the consensus of a package.
I see. Yes.
So they're going to have a hell of a time as long as we can get these arguments outside of Washington, D.C. People in the food markets we go into, the doctor's offices, this is going to grow. I believe that there's potential for a dramatic response by beneficiaries.
And
parenthetically, it's not just for old people or people with disabilities, obviously very important.
That's
It's also for working people who are moving towards retirement, and it's for our children in many ways, too.
Yes, indeed. Syracuse University professor and chairman of the Board of Social Security Works, Eric Kingston. Thank you, Professor, for joining us this morning.
Thank you for doing this. And it was also a fascinating discussion before me.
Thank you again. So when we come back, if a white person calls a black speaker at a public event articulate, is that racist? A study of how white people determine if it's racist or if it's sexist with author Betsy Leander Wright. Back in 60 seconds.
Peace. This is your social justice calendar for the week of March 31st, 2025. On April 1st from 6 to 9 p.m. and continuing on through April 4th, at the same time each day, the Palestinian Youth Movement will hold several volunteer sessions to prepare for the March on Washington on April 5th. The volunteer sessions to help prepare art, posters, and gear will be held at the Justice Center, D.C. on 617 Florida Avenue, Northwest Washington, D.C. More info can be found on Instagram at DMVPYM. On April 4th, from 6 to 8 p.m., The Sincere 7 presents a community conversation and film screening of an independently produced film by Tri Carswell. This will be located on Festival Center, 1640 Columbia Road, Northwest Washington, D.C. On April 5th at 1 p.m., the Palestinian Youth Movement and Answer Coalition, along with other various social advocacy groups, will march to demand a permanent ceasefire in Washington, D.C. For more info and updates, please go to marchforpalestine.org. Finally, on Sunday, April 6th at 7 p.m., Haile Garima and Sankofa Video and Books present Haiti on Our Mind, a bi-weekly community gathering showcasing artists and performers committed to liberation and justice, located at Sankofa Video Books and Cafe. More info can be found on Sankofa.com. The WPFW Social Justice Calendar connects you with the heartbeat of grassroots activism in the DMV. Submissions can be emailed to socialjustice@wpfw.org. Please include the name, date, and address of the event. Submissions are due by Thursday at 5 p.m. at least 1 week in advance of your event. WPFW's Social Justice Calendar helps build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Welcome back to What's at Stake. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Well, is it racist? Is it sexist? Betsy Leander Wright is the author, and she and her co-author, Jesse Shreve, went on a journey around the U.S. and through the decision-making process of white Americans. They interviewed Southerners, Northerners, Republicans and Democrats, working class, professional, middle class, men and women, all white, and Betsy and Jesse are white women as well. They presented them with various scenarios in an attempt to obtain insights into their thinking and judgment calls about race. Good morning, Betsy. Thank you for joining us on What's at Stake.
Thank you for inviting me, Verna.
So our nation is so racially polarized at this time that I would imagine that's what motivated you to seek some answers. And one statement that you made on the Boston Globe article really captured my attention. You said the fallacy of thinking that Trump voters are probably racist. And then you ultimately say that the reality is more complicated than that. Is that pretty much the essence of what your research revealed, that racism and sexism are very complicated?
Well, that we think about them so differently than each other. that we that was, as you said, that was the curiosity that started us on this research, is like white people's opinions in particular have polarized over the last 15 or so years so dramatically, more than any other group, and it to the point where within white families and, you know, obviously in politics, we can't even have civil conversations. Everybody's arguing with each other about, is there some people thinking there's a lot of racism and also sexism in our society, and some people isn't, and it's overblown and it's a liberal plot to blaming it. And we're like, what's behind these disagreements? How are people thinking so differently to come up with such opposite conclusions? And we really did learn a lot about even just how the definitions of what is racism are dramatically different. And that's some of why the conversations go so badly, is we're not even talking about the same thing.
Hmm. How many people did you all interview?
127. So it was a good number. We kept going until we could see there were themes that were coming up over and over and over again, and that we really understood the reasoning of the people that, you know, we both are liberals ourselves. And so we do believe there's a lot of racism and a lot of sexism in our society. But by the end of the study, I really came to understand why some people say, why some people disagree with that. And it was a hopeful study because not everybody who votes for Trump or who says the US isn't that racist, they're not all super right wing. They're not all, most of them are not hostile to people of color. Some of them are hostile to liberals. I think that was one of my big takeaways. It's like, there's not that much negativity towards people of color, but there's a lot of negativity towards liberals that we're really, white people are at each other's throats about these two issues. So, it did make me feel hopeful, even though obviously there's a lot of people who aren't seeing the racial disparities and the gender disparities in our society. But one thing that made me feel hopeful is that when they encountered racism that was fit their very, very narrow definition of what racism is, of intentional, deliberate harm towards to somebody based on their race, they were as angry about it and outspoken against it as the rest of us who think of ourselves, speaking of liberals and leftists, that we think of ourselves as the only white anti-racists. That's not necessarily true. In some situations, we could have a lot more allies than we think we could have.
So was there ever a right or wrong answer to the questions that you all posed? For example, was it racist for the white woman to say the black speaker was so articulate?
I think we weren't there to judge right or wrong. We were there to dig out the thinking behind why did about half of our people say yes, that a white audience member was being racist by the longstanding trope of oh, it's a black people, of oh, you're so articulate, as if expecting that they wouldn't be. Where they were coming from was knowing there is a pattern of African-Americans and other people of color getting that sense of surprise at their intelligence and their skills, as if there's low expectations. That's a national pattern that's been experienced by lots and lots of people of color. And so therefore, when we ask about this particular case, the answer is yes, that's racist. But for somebody for whom the definition of racism is it has to be deliberate harm, they would say things like, no, she's giving a compliment, she's trying to be nice. And so, no, it's not. And also, they asked a lot more questions. The more conservative people who usually said no, things aren't racist or sexist, they asked a lot of questions about the particular case on a theory of innocent till proven guilty. Mm-hmm. So they're like, there's not enough evidence here to say that she's coming from a racist place. So, and they don't believe in unconscious bias, which of course the liberals do. And so it was just fascinating to see the different reasoning. And I think that readers of our book are going to come out much better equipped to have conversations across the red-blue divide, and to understand each other, but also to persuade. I feel, after doing this research, better able to persuade a conservative person that I disagree with, and to build coalitions and have alliances.
Well, that's certainly exciting. That is what we need. But now, Betsy, you said, I know that you all divided people into two different groups. Either they are acquitters or convictors. And the acquitters seem to be the ones that ask all the questions. They kind of play the armchair detective, you know, when a situation comes up, and the convictor is like, hey, I've seen this movie before, and I know how it ends. So explain a little bit more as to these two groups that you divided folks into, and who's in those groups.
Right. Yeah, this was the pattern that emerged. That's the wonderful thing about social research. It's like, you don't know what you're going to find. But we found their answers were going into these two broad camps. And so we decided to use a courtroom metaphor, like, because we all have to make these judgment calls all the time. Is something racist or is something sexist? And it's as if we all find ourselves on a jury, and you need to vote to convict or acquit. And so that's why we use those terms, because some people just said, no, no, no. Every scenario, we gave things in the news, like Colin Kaepernick, what President Trump said to Colin Kaepernick, get that SOB off the field. Is that racist? And we use things from their lives, from the news, and these fictional scenarios, like you're saying. The acquitters are the people that tended to say in almost every case, unless there was deliberate malicious harm, no, it's not racist or it's not sexist. And the convictors are the people who, without asking any questions, jump to the conclusion because they knew there's a related national pattern. They would be, yes, that is racist or that is sexist. And neither of those approaches are perfect. I gotta say, I was pretty dismayed, since I believe in the definitions that the convictors have, because I believe there's institutionalized racism that doesn't require intent. I believe there's unconscious bias. And so discovering that the people I thought of as my people have these pretty bad habits of jumping to conclusions, it took me aback. So you asked who's in these two groups.
Mm-hmm.
We thought there might be social class differences, which is why we had half working class people and half professional middle class college educated people. And surprise, surprise, there weren't. There were small ones, but the acquitters are in both classes and the convictors are in both classes. And that breaks up some classist stereotypes that, oh, the really racist and the really sexist people are the working class white people. That turned out not to be true. Everything we heard from working class acquitters, we also heard from professional middle class acquitters. So that we busted that stereotype. We busted some stereotypes about the North and the South, although our Southerners were just in North Carolina. It might be different if we went farther south. But
Alabama, perhaps.
Yeah. We don't know, because we didn't ask that. But we had half in the North, half in the South. And both sets of attitudes are everywhere, in all classes, all genders, all regions. And really the thing that seemed to predict who would say no, be an acquitter. There's not racism. There's not sexism. And who would be a convictor and say, keep saying yes? It really is the media people consume and whether they feel affiliated with one of our big political tribes.
So now you said the acquitters, according to your study, the acquitters listened or consumed right-wing news media information.
The really political, ideological ones, not some of them consume no media at all, but the ones who were like mad at liberals and vehement about it and ideological about it, yeah, they were on Fox News and these right-wing podcasters and bloggers.
Mm. So let's just go through a couple of the scenarios. You said the white cop shoots the black teenager holding his cell phone and says he thought it was a gun.
Right.
And so acquitters, I would imagine, say, no, that wasn't racist because it wasn't enough evidence. I don't know. To me, and of course, I would probably be a convictor. Yeah. But
I figured.
Those acquitters, I mean, it sounds like they're just making up excuses not to call it racism.
Sometimes it did sound like that. Like they're always coming up with alternative explanations, considering alternative scenarios. They didn't necessarily, some of them would say things like, well, we don't have enough evidence there that he was motivated, the cop was motivated by racism. Maybe he was, but, you know, innocent till proven guilty. And it's, of course, true that we were showing them these cartoons and reading them these very short little anecdotes. And so it's true there isn't enough information. But the point that all the convictors knew and said mm-hmm. was this happens to people of color so much more than to white people. They know the statistics. And so they, on the basis of that, they say this fits a pattern and therefore it's racist. And
but on behalf of the acquitters, if they're not familiar with those patterns, because they're basically watching right-wing news, then they're not going to be inclined to say it's racism.
Right. Although that one scenario, not the really ideological right wingers, but the acquitters who just were kind of like colorblind, prided themselves on being colorblind or just really didn't follow news at all. That issue was the exception where they did know the pattern, because at the time of the interviews, the media had been saturated with that issue. And so that gave me hope that if we could get other racial disparities to saturate all mainstream media, we might have more white people start to believe in you know, health disparities, workplace disparities, et cetera. Mm.
Now we have a president who has outlawed anything he considers to be woke, quote unquote, and millions of Americans applaud him and the Musk actions. Is that racist?
Yeah, well, those are racist acts to take Black history, right? They're attacking the Smithsonian African American History Museum and taking down displays. Those acts for sure are racism, but the people who support Trump, that's not necessarily what they're most applauding. We talked to a lot of Trump voters. It was so educational for me that they were, you know, obviously very focused on the economy, very focused on the, you know, what they think of as border security, which you can argue is racist against some categories of immigrants, but they weren't the ones, the people who are against Trump raise his anti-DEI and his history of racism a lot. But the people who were Trump fans and Trump voters, that wasn't what they raised that they liked about him.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, you know, when people despair about like, oh no, the conservative white voters, Republicans, they're so excusing of racism. They must be really racist. But I think it's shooting ourselves in the foot to make that assumption.
Okay. So it's a really fascinating book, Betsy. And I have to I'm gonna invite you back. We can talk about some of the sexism because we didn't get to get to that this morning.
That would be great.
But if you can come back, we'll explore that a little bit. So this is Betsy Leander Wright, co-author of Is It Racist? Is It Sexist? And briefly, in closing, attorney Keith Boykin unpacks the real threat behind the Trump administration's closing down the famous African-American museum in Washington. Let's take a listen.
Donald Trump has issued an executive order attacking the National Museum of African-American History and Culture and threatening to remove funding from programs that promote what he calls an improper ideology. After days of failing to explain why his defense secretary was texting top secret war plans to a reporter, Trump is attacking black people to distract from Signalgate. The new executive order issued on Thursday attacks national museums for interrogating institutional racism. The horror! Imagine a museum in a country founded on slavery and segregation, having the audacity to explore the history of racism. This museum is one of the most popular museums in America, receiving 1.6 million visitors last year alone. Trump claims his order is designed to restore the Smithsonian to its rightful place as a symbol of inspiration and American greatness. So the guy who knows nothing about American history and thought that Frederick Douglass was alive just a few years ago thinks the only way we can celebrate American greatness is by whitewashing history and erasing the legacy of racism.
So what does this executive order do? Nothing! Yep, you heard it. It does absolutely nothing except to distract from his Signalgate scandal, stir outrage from black people, and convince his white MAGA supporters that he's sticking it to the coloreds. The order says the vice president, in consultation with a bunch of other people, shall work to effectuate Trump's goals through his role on the Smithsonian Board of Regents. All this does is tell J.D. Vance to be an on the Board of Regents that governs the Smithsonian. There are 17 members on the board, including several prominent Democrats, and J.D. Vance is just one of them. So he has no authority to make this happen. The order also says the vice president and the OMB director shall work with Congress to try to stop funding from programs that divide Americans based on race. That could have been an email or a public group chat. All it does is tell J.D. Vance to try to get Congress to cut funding for black exhibits that Trump doesn't like. The order does not cut funding for this museum or any other museum in the Smithsonian, and Trump doesn't have the authority to do so anyway. For the National Museum of African American History behind me, it's important to remember that 46% of its $81 million budget comes from federal appropriations, but most of the funding comes from private donations and general trust funds. So even if Trump and Vance convince the Republican Congress to cut funding, we as Americans can make up the annual $37 million in potential lost funding from the government for a few years until we get rid of these clowns in the White House. But here's the kicker. The same executive order that purports to restore truth and sanity to American history instructs the Department of Interior to reinstate Confederate monuments that were removed during the Biden administration. Yes, they're eliminating black contributions to American history. At the same time, they're celebrating the most racist white contributions, slavery and Civil War. You see, the Biden administration removed an infamous Confederate memorial here at Arlington National Cemetery and renamed military bases that had been named after Confederate generals. For those who don't remember history, the Confederates were the bad guys in the Civil War who broke away from the United States to preserve slavery. Trump doesn't like them being portrayed as bad guys. So let's review here. Trump's executive order does nothing to the National Museum of African American History and Culture except get people talking about it, which means it's all a distraction from the scandal over the Yemen attack, which itself was a distraction from the economy, according to Pete Hegseth's text message on Signal. This guy is like the opposite of Commissioner Gordon turning on the bat signal in Gotham. Whenever Trump gets in trouble, he turns on the chat signal, and all of the racists in MAGA world come running to his defense.
That was attorney Keith Boykin. Well, thank you, Betsy Leander Wright, for being our guest this morning. Thank you for listening to this week's edition of What's at Stake. Next week, the Reverend Mark Thomas will be in the host seat. Our engineer is Michael Nasella. Up next, Wake Up and Stay Woke with Dr. Ife Williams. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Ashe.
WPFW. Festival season is here, and on April 6th, noon until 7:30 p.m., Words, Beats, and Life kicks it off with the Jazz and Blossoms Park Jam. Family-friendly activities, art activations, food truck vendors, and performances will all happen in Franklin Park. Details at wblinc.org/WBLFest.
WPFW presents Still We Rise, our 48th anniversary celebration on Friday, April 25th, 7 to 11 p.m. at Martin's Crosswinds in Greenbelt. Entertainment includes Navasha Deya and more. That's Still We Rise, WPFW's 48th anniversary celebration. Details at wpfwfm.org.
Are you in the process of writing or updating your will, trust, or estate plan? We invite you to consider adding WPFW as a beneficiary through a charitable bequest. Bequests can take many forms and are usually the largest and most impactful gift a donor will ever make. Your bequest will help to ensure the programming WPFW has provided for almost 50 years will continue into the future. More info available by email at plannedgiving@wpfw.org or by phone at 202-588-0999, extension 344. Or you can let us know you've already included PFW in your plans through those same channels so we can add your name to our growing list of legacy listeners. We are listener supported. We are Jazz and Justice. And because of your support, we are WPFW.
Code Pink Women for Peace is coming to you live from Washington, D.C. and New York City, Thursday at 11 a.m. Code Pink Radio is an energizing new program focused on ending wars and militarism and building a peace economy. Listen weekly to robust conversation and inspiration from grassroots peacemakers from places like Korea, Yemen, Venezuela, Palestine, and Iran, as well as peacemakers in our nation's capital who are confronting war hawks in the White House and in Congress and modeling the actions we want our government to take. Again, that's Code Pink Radio, Thursdays at 11 a.m. on Washington, D.C.'s WPFW and New York City's WBAI, an engaging hour of cutting-edge conversation not to be missed.
We are women of the world. We're from the east, south, north, and west.
This Saturday, tens of thousands of people are converging on Washington, D.C. in a mass demonstration demanding the freedom of Mahmoud Khalil, Mamadou Tal, and all other student and faculty victims of repression who are being rounded up, imprisoned, expelled from their schools, and possibly deported simply for speaking out against the genocide in Gaza. The rally is our opportunity to raise our collective voices, demand our right to free speech, and stand with the suffering people of Palestine. On Saturday, April 5th, noon at 3rd and Pennsylvania Avenue, Northwest. Details at marchforpalestine.org. If you're unable to participate in person, WPFW will air live coverage from noon until 4 p.m. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Let me say free, free! Free, free! Free, free! Free, free! Free, free!
Greetings. WPFW is pleased to announce the relaunch of our major donor program, now known as the Jazz and Justice Circle. If you gave $1,000 last year or so far this year, you are automatically enrolled in this cherished group of listener members, and we thank you. Benefits of your membership are at wpfwfm.org.